Chapter 6. Understanding the environment. The only biosphere we have. This chapter's subtitle is deliberately preventive. I refuse to consider any near-term possibility of leaving the Earth and setting up a civilization on another planet. I do this because, in this post-factual world, musings about soon finding a new celestial abode, most notably the terraforming of Mars, have been presented as possible options to deal decisively with the problems of the third planet orbiting the Sun. This is yet another favourite topic of the sci-fi genre that will remain confined to its stories. Even if we had an inexpensive means of interplanetary transport and somehow mastered the construction of Martian bases, we could not create a suitable atmosphere. The processing of Martian polar caps, minerals and soil would yield only about 7% of all the CO2 that would be needed in order to warm the planet and make its prolonged colonization possible. Of course, the true believers can call on another sci-fi trick that could enable the colonization of Mars, creating radically genetically re-engineered humans, new superorganisms endowed with qualities of terrestrial tardigrades, tiny eight-legged invertebrates living on grass and in wet ditches. Such organisms would be able to cope not only with the thin atmosphere, its pressure is less than 1% of the terrestrial value, but also with the high radiation received by the poorly shielded red planet. Returning to the real world, if our species is to survive, never mind to flourish, for at least as long as high civilizations have been around, that is for another 5,000 or so years, then we will have to make sure that our continuing interventions do not imperil the long-term habitability of the planet, or, as modern parlance has it, that we do not transgress safe planetary boundaries. The list of these critical biospheric boundaries includes 9 categories. Climate change, now interchangeably albeit inaccurately called simply global warming. Ocean acidification, endangering marine organisms that build structures of calcium carbonate. Depletion of stratospheric ozone, shielding the Earth from excessive ultraviolet radiation and threatened by releases of chlorofluorocarbons. Atmospheric aerosols, pollutants reducing visibility and causing lung impairment. Interference in nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. Above all, the release of these nutrients into fresh and coastal waters. Freshwater use, excessive withdrawals of underground, stream and lake waters. Land use changes, due to deforestation, farming and urban and industrial expansion. Biodiversity loss and various forms of chemical pollution. Providing systematic reviews of all these concerns and setting them in their appropriate historical and environmental perspectives is a task for a major book, not for a single chapter, unless it consisted of superficial summaries. Instead, I've decided to give this chapter a decidedly utilitarian tilt and focus on just a few key existential parameters, starting with the environmental circumstances of 3 irreplaceable existential requirements: breathing, drinking, and eating. Provision of these 3 preconditions of our existence depends on natural goods and services, on the oxygenated atmosphere and its incessant circulation, on water and its global cycle, and on soils, photosynthesis, biodiversity, and flows of plant nutrients. In turn, their provision affects natural goods and services. As we will see, these effects range from marginal. Oxygen concentrations in the atmosphere are in no danger because of fossil fuel combustion. Too obviously negative, excessive water extraction from ancient deep aquifers, serious water pollution generated by food production, cities and industries. Too outright destructive. Overgrazing in arid regions leading to desertification, new cropland displacing tropical forests or grasslands. Oxygen is in no danger. Breathing is the regular delivery of oxygen carried from our lungs by hemoglobin to all cells in the body to energize our metabolism. No provision of a natural resource is as critical for our survival. Duration of bearable voluntary apnea, the cessation of breathing, varies, but if you have never trained yourself to prolong your breathless periods, you will find out that you can last as little as 30 seconds, and typically no longer than about a minute or so. you might have read about free diving, where men and women risk their lives by holding their breath and diving without any breathing apparatus, as deep as they can endure with or without fins, or about static apnea competitions, where the contestants lie motionless in a pool of water and hold their breath. The latter record for men is nearly 12 minutes, for women 9 minutes, while hyperventilating with pure oxygen for up to half an hour before an attempt doubles apneic time to more than 24 minutes for men and 18 and a half minutes for women. This passes for sport in the 21st century, despite the fact that brain cells start to die within 5 minutes of cerebral hypoxia, and that an only slightly longer period can cause severe damage or death. Oxygen, after all, is the most acutely limiting resource for human survival. Our species, like all other chemoheterotrophs, organisms that cannot internally produce their own nutrition, requires its constant supply. The resting frequency of breathing is 12 to 20 inhalations a minute, and the daily adult per capita intake averages almost 1 kilogram of O2. For the global population, that translates to an annual intake of about 2.7 billion tons of oxygen a year, an utterly insignificant fraction, 0.00023%, of the element's atmospheric presence of about 1.2 quadrillion tons of O2, and the exhaled CO2 is readily used by photosynthesizing plants. The beginnings of the oxygenated atmosphere go back to what has become known as the Great Oxidation Event, which began about 2.5 billion years ago. During that period, oxygen released by oceanic cyanobacteria began to accumulate in the atmosphere, but it took a long time before the gases reached their modern concentrations. During the past 500 million years, atmospheric oxygen levels fluctuated widely, being as low as about 15% and as high as 35% before they declined to today's nearly 21% of the Earth's atmosphere by volume. As well as there being absolutely no danger of people or animals appreciably reducing this level through breathing, there is also no danger of too much oxygen being consumed by even the greatest conceivable burning, rapid oxidation of the Earth's plants. The Earth's terrestrial plant mass contains on the order of 500 billion tons of carbon, and even if all of it, all forests, grasslands and crops, were burned at once, such a mega conflagration would consume only about 0.1% of the atmosphere's oxygen. And yet, during the summer of 2019, when large areas of the Amazon rainforest were burning, news media and politicians tried to frighten the scientifically illiterate masses into believing that the world would start suffocating. One among many, on August the 22nd, 2019, the French President Emmanuel Macron tweeted, "Our house is burning. Literally. The Amazon rainforest, the lungs, which produces 20% of our planet's oxygen, is on fire. It is an international crisis. Members of the G7 summit, let's discuss this emergency first order in 2 days." There was no emergency G7 summit in 2 days, or even 2 months, a good thing too, as if that could fix anything. And the world keeps on breathing. Depending on where you happen to be on this specific judgmental scale, deliberate burning of the Amazon rainforest is either a highly regrettable and completely misguided policy or an unpardonable crime against the biosphere. But know that it is not an act that will deprive the planet of its oxygen. This misinformation also illustrates a far wider problem. Namely, why are we not relying on well-established scientific facts and instead, why do we let assorted tweets drive public opinion? Appraisals of the environment are perhaps even more prone to unwarranted generalisation, biased interpretation, and outright misinformation than those of energy and food production. This tendency must be condemned and resisted. We will not succeed if our actions are based on myths and misinformation. Admittedly, the underlying science is often complex, and many verdicts are uncertain and resolute judgments are unadvisable, but not in this particular case. Most obviously, lungs do not produce oxygen, they process it. The function of lungs is to enable gas exchange as atmospheric O2 enters the bloodstream and CO2, the most voluminous gaseous product of metabolism, leaves it. In the process, Lungs, as any other organ, must consume oxygen, but it is not easy to measure how much of it they need. That is, to separate their requirement from the overall intake. The best way to find out is during a total cardiopulmonary bypass, when lung circulation is temporarily separated from systemic blood flow. This shows that lungs consume about 5% of the total oxygen we inhale. And while Amazonian trees, as any terrestrial plants, produce O2 during diurnal photosynthesis, they, again, much as any other photosynthesizing organism, consume virtually all of this oxygen during nocturnal respiration, the process that uses photosynthate to produce energy and compounds for plant growth. Every year, at least 300 billion tons of oxygen are absorbed, and a similar amount is released by terrestrial and marine photosynthesis. These flows, as well as much smaller flows resulting from the burial and oxidation of organic matter, are not perfectly balanced on a daily or seasonal basis, but over the long run they cannot be too far off. Otherwise, we would have substantial net gains or losses of the element. Instead, oxygen's atmospheric presence has been remarkably stable. Images of burning Amazonian forest, Australian scrubland, Californian hillsides, or Siberian taiga are not ominous harbingers of an atmosphere deprived of the gas we need to inhale at least a dozen times a minute. Massive forest fires are destructive and harmful in many ways, but they are not going to suffocate us because of a lack of oxygen. Will we have enough water and food? In contrast, the provision of the second most acutely required natural input should be very high on our list of environmental worries. And not because there is any absolute shortage of this critical resource, but because it is unevenly distributed and because we have not managed it well. And that is an understatement. We waste water enormously, and so far we have been slow to adopt many effective changes that would reverse undesirable habits and trends. As we will see, water supply is thus a perfect example of an almost universally mismanaged resource, with the added complication of highly uneven access. At least we do not have to drink as often as we breathe. A dozen times a minute, not even a dozen times a day, but the provision of adequate volumes of drinking water, which, depending on gender, age, body size, ambient temperature, and excluding extreme activities, is mostly between 1.5 and 3 litres a day, is a matter of basic survival. No rehydration for a day is a trying experience. For 2 days, it becomes perilous. For 3 days, it is usually fatal. Beyond this existential necessity, translating to a per capita average of about 750 kilograms, or litres, or 0.75 cubic metres, of water a year, there are several other and much more voluminous water needs. For personal hygiene, cooking and laundry, even without an indoor toilet, these categories add up to the minima of 15 to 20 litres a day, or about 7 cubic metres a year. For productive activities, and above all, for growing food. Different sectors of water use – agriculture, thermal electricity generation, heavy industries, light manufacturing, services, household – and different categories of water complicate intranational and international comparisons. Blue water includes rainfall entering rivers, water bodies, and groundwater storage that gets incorporated into products or evaporates. The green water footprint accounts for water from precipitation that is stored in soil and subsequently evaporated, transpired, or incorporated by plants. Grey water includes all the fresh water required to dilute pollutants in order to meet specific water quality standards. This is why national per capita consumption is the best, the most exhaustive, way to assess water footprints. It adds green, blue and grey water components as well as all virtual water, water that was required for the growth or production of imported food and manufactured goods. Domestic blue water use, all values are in cubic metres per year per capita, ranges from just over 29 in Canada and 23 in the USA to about 11 in France, 7 in Germany and about 5 in China and India, and to less than 1 in many African countries. The total water footprint of national consumption reflects specific shares of water used in agriculture, obviously highest in countries with extensive irrigation, and industrial production. As a result, economies with very different climates and sectoral consumption, Canada and Italy, Israel and Hungary, have similar consumption totals. In all these cases, between 2,300 and 2,400 cubic meters per year per capita. Food imports incorporate considerable amounts of green water, and hence the two countries with the highest dependence on imported food, Japan, South Korea, are also the highest users of virtual water. Not surprisingly, water's critical role in national economies in general, and in food production in particular, has resulted in many comprehensive appraisals of its availability, sufficiency, scarcity, and vulnerability. At the beginning of the 21st century, water-stressed populations totaled as low as 1.2 billion and as high as 4.3 billion. That is between 20 and 70% of all humanity. Similarly, during the second decade of the 21st century, two different measures of water scarcity indicated that the affected populations were between 1.6 and 2.4 billion people. Given these major differences in present assessments, it is impossible to offer strongly defensible conclusions about the future. There are also many uncertainties concerning the future provision of food. No other human activity has transformed the Earth's ecosystems to a greater extent than the production of food. It already adds up to about a third of the planet's non-glaciated land, and further impacts are inevitable. The combined area devoted to food production is now more than twice as large as it was a century ago. But in all affluent economies, the land under cultivation has either stabilized or has slightly decreased, while the overall global growth of new farmland has slowed down considerably. Given the continent's still high fertility rates, further expansion of cultivated land will be inevitable in Africa, but only limited extension should take place in most of Asia, while Europe, North America, and Australia, with already excessive food production and aging populations, should see further declines in cultivated land. The amount of land used in food production could be reduced with the combination of better farming practices, reduced food waste, and the widespread adoption of moderate meat consumption. As already explained in Chapter 2, reversion to pre-industrial farming is inconceivable in a world of nearly 8 billion people, but getting higher yields with existing inputs, agricultural intensification, conforms to a long-established trend. And the elimination of many wasteful practices could produce higher yields, even with reduced fertilizer or pesticide use. A convincing large-scale, decade-long, 2005 to 2015, demonstration of this included nearly 21 million farmers cultivating about a third of China's cropland. They were able to raise staple grain yields by 11% while reducing the application of nitrogen per hectare by 15 to 18%. If land is not a limiting resource, and if we have the know-how to manage water supply, what are the prospects for providing the macronutrients our crops need while also limiting the environmental impact of applying nitrogen and phosphorus? As already explained, the Haber-Bosch synthesis of ammonia made it possible to provide a reactive form of nitrogen, the leading macronutrient, in any desirable quantity. We can also provide adequate amounts of the two mineral macronutrients, potassium and phosphorus. The US Geological Survey puts potassium resources at about 7 billion tons of K2O, potassium oxide equivalent. Reserves are about half that amount, and at the current rate of production, these reserves would last for nearly 90 years. During the last 50 years, there have been periodic comments about imminent phosphorus shortages, some even raising the inevitability of starvation in a matter of decades. Concerns about wasting a finite resource are always appropriate, but there is no imminent phosphorus crisis. According to the International Fertilizer Development Center, the world's phosphate rock reserves and resources are adequate to meet fertilizer demand for the next 300 to 400 years. The US Geological Survey puts the world resources of phosphate rock at more than 300 billion tons, sufficient for more than 1,000 years at the current rate of extraction. And the International Fertilizer Industry Association does not believe that peak phosphorus is a pressing issue or that phosphate rock depletion is imminent. The real concern about plant nutrients is the environmental and hence economic consequences of their unwanted presence in the environment, mostly in water. Phosphorus from fertilizers is lost through soil erosion and precipitation runoff, and it is released in waste produced by domestic animals and people. Because water, whether fresh or ocean, normally has very low concentrations of this element, its additions lead to eutrophication, the enrichment of waters with previously scarce nutrients that results in the excessive growth of algae. Losses of nitrogen from fertilized farmland and from animal and human waste also cause eutrophication, but aquatic photosynthesis is more responsive to phosphorus additions. Neither primary sewage treatment, sedimentation removes 5 to 10% of phosphorus, nor secondary removal, filtration captures 10 to 20%, prevents eutrophication, but phosphorus can be removed by using coagulating agents or by microbial processes, then turned into crystals and reused as fertilizer. As already explained, the worldwide efficiency of nitrogen uptake by crops has declined to less than 50% and to below 40% in China and France. In conjunction with phosphorus, soluble nitrogen compounds contaminate waters and support excessive algal growth. Decomposing algae consume oxygen dissolved in seawater and create oxygenless or anoxic waters where fish and crustaceans cannot survive. These oxygen-depleted zones are prominent along the eastern and southern coasts of the United States and along coasts in Europe, China, and Japan. There are no easy, inexpensive, and rapid solutions to these environmental impacts. Better agronomic management, crop rotations, split applications of fertilizers to minimize their losses, is essential, and reduced meat consumption would be the single most important adjustment as it would lower the need for producing feed grains. But sub-Saharan Africa will need much more nitrogen and phosphorus if it is to avoid chronic dependence on food imports. And any longer-term assessment of the three existential necessities – atmospheric oxygen, water availability, and food production – must consider how their provision could be affected by the unfolding process of climate change, a gradual transformation that will leave its mark on the biosphere in myriad ways. The impacts go far beyond higher temperatures and rising ocean levels, the two changes that are most often referenced by the media. I will not revisit a long list of predicted impacts, from broiling cities to rising oceans, from desiccated crops to melted glaciers. That has been done, in measured ways as well as in hysterical fashion, too many times. Instead, I will take a utilitarian and unorthodox approach. I will start by explaining the life-enabling necessity of the greenhouse gas effect, without which the Earth's surface would be permanently frozen, and which we have unintentionally enhanced by a combination of actions, with the combustion of fossil fuels being the most important driver of anthropogenic global warming. Then I will explain how, contrary to a common perception, modern science identified this phenomenon more than a century ago. How we have ignored clearly stated potential risks for generations, how we have been so far unwilling to commit to any effective action to change the course of global warming, and how extraordinarily challenging such a shift would be. Why the Earth is not permanently frozen. As we heard in the first chapter, the abundance of fossil fuels and their increasingly more efficient conversions have been the dominant energizers of modern economic growth, bringing us the benefits of greater longevity and richer lives, but also concerns about the long-term effects of CO2 emissions on the global climate, commonly referred to as global warming. Simple physics explains our worries about the environmental consequences of planetary warming. We are concerned about too much of something without which we could not be alive, the greenhouse effect. This existential imperative is the regulation of the Earth's atmospheric temperature by a few trace gases, above all by carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, CH4. Compared to the two gases that make the bulk of the atmosphere, nitrogen at 78%, oxygen at 21%, their presence is negligible, small fractions of a percent. But their effect makes the difference between a lifeless frozen planet and a blue and green Earth. The Earth's atmosphere absorbs the incoming shortwave solar radiation and radiates longer waves to space. Without it, the temperature of the Earth would be minus 18 degrees Celsius, and hence our planet's surface would be perpetually frozen. Trace gases change the planet's radiation balance by absorbing some of the outgoing infrared radiation and raising the surface temperature. This allows for the existence of liquid water, whose evaporation puts water vapor, another gas that absorbs outgoing infrared invisible waves, into the atmosphere. The overall result is that the Earth's surface temperature is 33 degrees Celsius higher than it would be in the absence of trace gases and water vapor, and the global mean temperature of 15 degrees Celsius supports life in its many forms. Labeling this natural phenomenon as the greenhouse effect is a misleading analogy, because the heat inside a greenhouse is there not only because the glass enclosure prevents the escape of some infrared radiation, but also because it cuts off air circulation. In contrast, the natural greenhouse effect is caused solely by the interception of a small share of outgoing infrared radiation by trace gases, while the global atmosphere remains in constant, unimpeded, and often violent motion. Water vapor is by far the most important absorber of outgoing radiation, and hence it is the gas that has been responsible for most of the atmospheric warming in the past, and it will remain so in the future. Water vapor is the principal generator of the natural greenhouse effect, but water vapor is not the cause of atmospheric warming because it does not control atmospheric temperature. In fact, it is the other way round. The changing temperature determines how much water can be present as a gas. The humidity of air increases with rising temperatures, and how much it condenses to liquid, condensation increases as the temperature drops. The Earth's natural warming is controlled by trace gases, whose concentration is not affected by the ambient temperature, that is, they do not condense and precipitate as temperatures decline. But the relatively small warming they cause increases evaporation and raises atmospheric water concentrations, and this feedback results in additional warming. The natural trace gas effect has always been dominated by carbon dioxide, or CO2. With smaller contributions made by methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N2O, and ozone, O3, the latter known to many via the eponymous ozone layer. Human actions began to affect the concentrations of several trace gases, creating an additional man-made anthropogenic greenhouse gas effect thousands of years ago, as soon as settled societies adopted farming and began using wood and the charcoal made from it in households and when smelting metals and making bricks and tiles. The conversion of forests to cropland released additional CO2, and cultivation of rice in flooded fields produced additional CH4. But the impact of these anthropogenic emissions became significant only with the increasing pace of industrialization. Rising CO2 emissions, which cause an accelerated anthropogenic greenhouse gas effect, have been driven primarily by the combustion of fossil fuels and by the production of cement. Methane emissions from rice fields, landfills, cattle and natural gas production, and nitrous oxide, originating mostly from the rising application of nitrogenous fertilizers, are the other notable anthropogenic sources of greenhouse gases. Reconstructions of their past atmospheric concentrations show the sudden increase brought on by industrialization. For centuries before 1800, CO2 levels fluctuated narrowly at close to 270 parts per million, ppm, that is 0.027% by volume. By 1900, they rose slightly to 290 ppm. A century later, they were nearly 375 ppm, and in the summer of 2020, they rose above 420 ppm, more than a 50% increase above the late 18th century level. Pre-industrial methane levels were three orders of magnitude lower, less than 800 parts per billion, ppb, but they have more than doubled to nearly 1,900 ppb by 2020, while nitrous oxide concentrations rose from about 270 ppb to more than 300 ppb. These gases absorb the outgoing radiation to different degrees. When their impacts are compared over a 100-year period, releasing a unit of CH4 has the same effect as releasing 28 to 36 units of CO2. For N2O, the multiplier is between 265 and 298. A handful of new man-made industrial gases, above all chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, in the past used in refrigeration, and SF6, an excellent insulator used in electrical equipment, exert a far stronger effect. But fortunately, they are present only in minuscule concentrations, and the production of CFCs was gradually outlawed by the 1987 Montreal Protocol. CO2, mostly emitted from fossil fuel combustion, with deforestation being another major source, accounts for about 75% of the anthropogenic warming effect, CH4 for about 15%, and the rest is mostly N2O. The continued rise of greenhouse gas emissions will eventually lead to temperatures high enough to cause many negative environmental impacts, engendering considerable social and economic costs. Contrary to a widely held impression, this is not a recent conclusion arising from a better understanding provided by complex climate change models executed by supercomputers. We knew this not only long before the first models of global atmospheric circulation, precursors of all global warming simulations, were introduced during the late 1960s, but generations before the first electronic computers were even built. Who discovered global warming? If you check Google's Ngram Viewer for the appearance of global warming, you will discover the virtual absence of the phrase before 1980, followed by a steep rise in frequency, quadrupling in the 2 years before 1990. The discovery of carbon dioxide-induced global warming by the media, public, and politicians came in 1988, spurred by America's warm summer and by the establishment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, by the UN's Environment Programme, UNEP, and by the World Meteorological Organization, WMO. This led to a still rising tide of scientific papers, books, conferences, think tank studies, and reports prepared by governments and international organizations, including the IPCC's periodic state-of-the-art reviews. By 2020, a Google search returned more than a billion items for global warming and global climate change. This frequency is an order of magnitude higher than those for such recently fashionable news items as globalization or economic inequality, or for such existential challenges as poverty and malnutrition. Moreover, almost since the very beginning of the media's interest in this complex process, the coverage of global warming has been replete with poorly communicated facts, dubious interpretations, and dire predictions. And over time, it has definitely acquired a distinctly more hysterical, even outright apocalyptic flavour. Uninformed observers would have to conclude that these warnings of an unfolding global catastrophe reflect the very latest scientific findings based on a combination of previously unavailable satellite observations and on the forecasts using complex global climate models whose execution has been made possible by the rise of computing power. But while our latest monitoring and modelling are certainly more advanced, there is nothing new either about our understanding of the greenhouse effect or about the consequences of steadily increasing emissions of greenhouse gases. In principle, we have been aware of them for more than 150 years, and in a clear and explicit manner, for more than a century. A few years before his death, Joseph Fourier, 1768 to 1830, a French mathematician, was the first scientist to realise that the atmosphere absorbs some of the radiation emanating from the ground, and in 1856, Eunice Foote, an American scientist and inventor, was the first author to link, briefly but clearly, CO2 with global warming. 5 years later, John Tyndall, 1820 to 1893, an English physicist, explained that water vapour is the most important absorber of the outgoing radiation, which means that every variation of this constituent must produce a change in climate. And he added that similar remarks would apply to the carbonic acid diffused through the air. Concise but clear, when rephrased in modern parlance, it says, increases in CO2 concentration must produce rising atmospheric temperature. That was in 1861. And before the end of the century, Svante Arrhenius, 1859 to 1927, a Swedish chemist and an early Nobelian, published the first calculations of increased global surface temperature arising from the eventual doubling of pre-industrial atmospheric CO2. His paper also noted that global warming will be felt least in the tropics and most felt in the polar regions, and that it will reduce temperature differences between night and day. Both of these conclusions have been confirmed. The Arctic warms up faster, but the simplest explanation, with the melting of snow and ice, the share of reflected radiation declines sharply, leading to higher warming, is only a part of a complex process that includes changes in clouds and water vapour and energy transport to the poles through large weather systems. Nighttime temperatures are increasing faster than the daytime averages, mainly because the boundary layer, the atmosphere just above the ground, is very thin, mere hundreds of metres during the night compared to several kilometres during the day, and hence it is more sensitive to warming. In 1908, Arrhenius provided a fairly accurate estimate of climate sensitivity. The measure of global warming arising from a doubling of atmospheric CO2 level, any doubling of the percentage of carbon dioxide in the air would raise the temperature of the Earth's surface by 4 degrees Celsius. In 1957, 3 decades before the sudden surge of interest in global warming, Roger Revelle, an American oceanographer, and Hans Suess, a physical chemist, appraised the process of mass-scale fossil fuel combustion in its correct evolutionary terms. Thus, human beings are now carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that could not have happened in the past, nor be reproduced in the future. Within a few centuries, we are returning to the atmosphere and oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored in sedimentary rocks over hundreds of millions of years. I cannot imagine what other phrasing could have better conveyed the unprecedented nature of this new reality. Just a year later, in response to this concern, the measurement of background CO2 concentrations began at Mauna Loa in Hawaii and at the South Pole, and they immediately showed constant and fairly predictable annual increases, from 315 ppm in 1958 to 346 ppm by 1985. And in 1979, a report by the National Research Council put the theoretical value of climate sensitivity, including water vapour feedback, at 1.5 degrees Celsius to 4.5 degrees Celsius, which means that the estimate offered by Arrhenius in 1908 was well within that range. The late 1980s discovery of carbon dioxide-induced global warming thus came more than a century after Foote and Tyndall made the link clear. Nearly 4 generations after Arrhenius published a good quantitative estimate of the possible global warming effect, more than a generation after Revelle and Suess warned about an unprecedented and unrepeatable planet-wide geophysical experiment, and a decade after modern confirmation of climate sensitivity. Clearly, we did not have to wait for new computer models or for the establishment of an international bureaucracy to be aware of this change and to think about our responses. How little fundamental difference these efforts have made is perhaps best illustrated by the latest estimates of a key global warming metric, climate sensitivity. The IPCC's 5th assessment report, published more than a century after Arrhenius offered the value of 4 degrees Celsius, concluded that it is extremely unlikely that the sensitivity is less than 1 degree Celsius and very unlikely that it is above 6 degrees Celsius, with the likely range between 1.5 degrees Celsius and 4.5 degrees Celsius, the same as the 1979 National Research Council report. And in 2019, a comprehensive assessment of Earth's climate sensitivity, using multiple lines of evidence, narrowed the most likely response to between 2.6 degrees Celsius and 3.9 degrees Celsius. This means that climate sensitivity is extremely unlikely to be so low that it could prevent substantial warming in excess of 2 degrees Celsius by the time the atmospheric CO2 concentration rises to about 560 ppm, twice the pre-industrial level. And yet, so far, the only effective, substantial moves towards decarbonisation have not come from any determined, deliberate, targeted policies. Rather, they have been byproducts of general technical advances. higher conversion efficiencies, more nuclear and hydro generation, less wasteful processing and manufacturing procedures, and of ongoing production and management shifts. Switching from coal to natural gas, more common, less energy-intensive material recycling, whose initiation and progress had nothing to do with any quest for reduced greenhouse gas emissions. And as already noted, the global impact of the recent turn toward decarbonizing electricity generation by installing solar PV panels and wind turbines has been completely negated by the rapid rise of greenhouse gas emissions in China and elsewhere in Asia. Oxygen, water, and food in a warmer world. We know where we stand. Because of the rising concentrations of greenhouse gases, the planet has been, for generations, re-radiating slightly less energy than it has been receiving from the sun. By 2020, the net value of this difference was about 2 watts per square meter compared to the 1850 baseline. Because oceans have an enormous capacity to absorb atmospheric heat, it takes a long time to raise the average temperature of the lower atmosphere by an appreciable margin. During the late 2010s, after a couple of centuries of accelerated burning of fossil fuels, the temperature averaged across global land and ocean surfaces was almost 1 degree Celsius above the 20th century mean. It has been documented on all continents, but it has not been evenly distributed. As Arrhenius rightly predicted, higher latitudes have seen much higher average increases than the mid-latitudes or the tropics. In terms of the global average, the 5 warmest years in the past 140 years have happened since 2015, and 9 of the 10 warmest years have been experienced since 2005. There have been many consequences of this global change, ranging from the earlier flowering of Kyoto's cherry trees and earlier vintages of French wines to worrisome new temperature records during summer heat waves and the melting of high mountain glaciers. And, not surprisingly, given the ease of playing with many computer models, there is now an even more extensive literature predicting what is to come. So, circling back to the 3 existential fundamentals, what is the outlook for oxygen, water, and food supply on a warmer Earth? Oxygen's atmospheric concentration is not affected by any slight greenhouse gas-driven changes in temperature, but it has been marginally declining because of the principal anthropogenic cause of global warming, the burning of fossil fuels. Their combustion has recently been removing about 27 billion tons of oxygen a year from the atmosphere. Net annual decline of atmospheric oxygen, also taking into account its losses due to wildfires and livestock respiration, was put at about 21 billion tons at the beginning of the 21st century. That is, less than 0.002% of the existing concentration a year. Direct measurements of atmospheric O2 concentrations confirm these tiny losses. Recently, they have been about 4 ppm. And, as there are nearly 210,000 oxygen molecules among every 1 million molecules of air, this translates to an annual decline of 0.002%. At this rate, it would take 1,500 years, roughly equal to the time that has elapsed since the demise of the Western Roman Empire, to lower oxygen's atmospheric level by 3%. But in terms of actual O2 concentrations, that is merely the equivalent of moving from New York City at sea level to Salt Lake City, 1,288 metres above sea level. Another extreme and completely theoretical calculation shows that even should we burn all of the world's known reserves of all fossil fuels, coal, crude oil, and natural gas, an impossibility due to the prohibitive costs of extracting these fuels from mostly marginal deposits, atmospheric O2 concentration would be reduced by just 0.25%. Unfortunately, for hundreds of millions of people, breathing is made difficult for many reasons, ranging from pollen allergens to outdoor, urban, and indoor, from cooking, rural air pollution. But there is no risk of impaired breathing caused by any conceivable decline of atmospheric oxygen consumed by forest fires or by fossil fuel combustion. Moreover, no access to a vital natural resource is so equitable. Whatever the local level of air pollutants, at the same altitude anywhere in the world, An identical concentration of oxygen is freely available to anybody. Populations living at high altitudes, in places like Tibet and the Andes, have shown many remarkable adaptations. Above all, elevated hemoglobin concentrations to lower oxygen concentrations. All that is to say, we should not worry about oxygen. However, we must be concerned about the future of the water supply. Many regional, national, and global models have examined future water availability. They assume different degrees of global warming, and while the worst-case scenarios offer a generally deteriorating outlook, there are substantial uncertainties depending on necessary assumptions about population growth and therefore water demand. With a warming of up to 2 degrees Celsius, populations exposed to increased climate change-induced water scarcity may be as low as 500 million and as high as 3.1 billion. Per capita water supply will be decreasing worldwide, but some major river basins, including La Plata, the Mississippi, Danube, and Ganges, will remain well above the scarcity level, while some already water-scarce river basins will see further deterioration, perhaps most notably Turkey and Iraq's Tigris-Euphrates and China's Huanghe. But most studies concur that demand-driven freshwater scarcity will have a much greater impact than the shortages induced by climate change. As a result, our best option for dealing with future water supply is to manage demand. And one of the best large-scale examples of this working is the recent history of the US's reducing per capita water usage. In 2015, overall US water consumption was less than 4% higher than it was in 1965. But during the intervening 50 years, the country's population increased by 68%. Its GDP, in constant monies, more than quadrupled, and irrigated farmland increased by about 40%. This means that average per capita water use decreased by nearly 40%, that the water intensity of the US economy, units of water per unit of constant GDP, declined by 76%, and as the total volume of water used for irrigation was actually slightly lower in 2015, that applications per unit of farmland declined by nearly a third. There are, of course, physical limits to the further reduction in all of these uses of water, but the US experience shows that the gains can go far beyond marginal ones. The shortage of drinking water can be alleviated by desalination, the removal of dissolved salts from seawater by techniques ranging from solar distillation to the use of semi-permeable membranes. This option has become more common in many water-short countries. There are some 18,000 desalination plants around the world, but the costs are well above those of fresh water supplied from reservoirs or from recycling. The volumes of water needed for crops are of a much higher magnitude, and most of the world's food production will continue to depend on rainfall. Will there be enough of it in the coming warmer world? Photosynthesis is always an extremely lopsided exchange of internal water inside a leaf for external CO2 in the atmosphere. Anytime a plant opens its stomata, located on the underside of leaves, to import sufficient carbon for its photosynthesis, it loses large amounts of water. For example, transpiration efficiency, biomass produced per unit of water used, of wheat, whole plant, is 5.6 to 7.5 grams per kilogram. And this translates to about 240 to 330 kilograms of water per kilogram of harvested grain. Global warming will inevitably intensify the water cycle because higher temperatures will increase evaporation. As a result, there will be overall more precipitation and hence more water available for capture, storage, and use. But more precipitation in general will not mean more precipitation everywhere. Nor, a no less important consideration, more precipitation when it is most needed. As with many other changes associated with a warmer climate, enhanced precipitation will be unevenly distributed. Some regions will be receiving less than today. Others, including the Yangtze Basin, home to most of China's large population, significantly more. And this increase is expected to bring a slight reduction in the number of people residing in highly water-stressed environments. But many places with more precipitation will get it in a more irregular manner, in the form of less frequent but heavier, even catastrophic, rain or snow events. A warmer atmosphere will also enhance water loss from plants, evapotranspiration, but that does not mean that crops and forests will wilt as they lose water. A rising atmospheric level of CO2 means that the water required per unit of yield will decrease in a warmer and CO2-richer biosphere. This effect has already been measured in some crops, and wheat and rice, staple grains which rely on the most common photosynthetic pathway, will increase their water use efficiency more than corn or sugarcane, which use a less common but inherently more efficient pathway. This means that in some regions, wheat and other crops could yield as much or more than today, even if the precipitation they receive is reduced by 10 to 20%. At the same time, global food production is also a significant source of trace gases that contribute to global warming, mostly CO2, from conversions of forests and pastures to fields, still ongoing above all in South America and Africa, and methane emissions from ruminant livestock. But this reality also presents opportunities for improvements and adjustments. Crops could be grown in ways that increase organic matter in soils and hence their carbon storage by reducing or eliminating annual ploughing, and methane emissions from livestock could be lowered by eating less beef. My calculations show that in the future, by lowering the share of beef and raising the share of pork, chicken meat, eggs and dairy products, by more efficient feeding and by better use of crop residues and food processing byproducts, we could match recent global meat output while greatly limiting livestock's environmental impact, including its share of methane emissions. More broadly, a recent study asked if it is possible to feed the future population of 10 billion people, expected shortly after 2050, within four terrestrial planetary boundaries. In other words, doing so without taking the Earth and its inhabitants to the brink in terms of transgressing the limits on the biosphere's integrity, land and freshwater use, and nitrogen flow. Not surprisingly, the study concluded that if all those boundaries were strictly respected, the global food system could supply balanced daily diets, about 2,400 kilocalories per capita, to no more than 3.4 billion people, but that 10.2 billion could be supported with the redistribution of cropland, better water and nutrient management, food waste reduction, and dietary adjustments. Informed looks at the three existential necessities of life, breathing, drinking, and eating, concur. There should be no unavoidable apocalypse by 2030 or 2050. Oxygen will remain abundant. Concerns about water supply will increase in many regions, but we have the knowledge and we should be able to mobilise the means needed to avert any mass-scale life-threatening shortages. And we should not only maintain but improve average per capita food supply in low-income countries while reducing excessive production in affluent nations. However, these actions would only reduce, not eliminate, our reliance on direct and indirect fossil fuel subsidies in the production of food for the global population. Reference Chapter 2. And, as I explained in the first chapter, moving away from fossil fuels cannot be done rapidly. This means that for decades to come, their combustion will remain the principal driver of global climate change. How will this affect the long-term trend of global warming? Uncertainties, promises, and realities. The combination of scientific advances and improving technical capabilities means that we now approach any complex process that involves the intricate interplay of natural factors and human actions with the advantages of considerable and steadily expanding understanding. At the same time, we also have to reckon with uncomfortable degrees of ignorance and with persistent uncertainties that make any resolute response so much more difficult. If a reminder of this fundamental reality was needed, then the spread and the consequences of COVID-19 provided many sobering global lessons. We were unprepared, to a degree even those of us who expected major problems found surprising, for an event whose near imminent occurrence could have been forecast with 100% certainty. In 2008, I did so unequivocally in my book on global catastrophes and trends, getting even the timing right. Although we almost immediately identified the full genetic makeup of this new pathogen, national public policy responses to its spread ranged from largely business as usual, Sweden, to draconian but belated countrywide shutdowns, Italy, Spain, and from early dismissals, the US in February 2020, to early successes that turned into later problems, Singapore. And yet, fundamentally, this is a self-limiting natural phenomenon that we've experienced on a global scale three times since the late 1950s. Even without any vaccines, every viral pandemic eventually subsides once the pathogen infects relatively large numbers of people or once it mutates into a less virulent form. In contrast, global climate change is an extraordinarily complex development whose eventual outcome depends on far from perfectly understood interactions of many natural and anthropogenic processes. As a result, we will need for decades to come more observations, more studies, and far better climate models in order to get more accurate appraisals of long-term trends and of the most likely outcomes. To believe that our understanding of these dynamic, multifactorial realities has reached the state of perfection is to mistake the science of global warming for the religion of climate change. At the same time, we do not need an endless stream of new models in order to take effective actions. There are enormous opportunities for reducing energy use in buildings, transportation, industry, and agriculture. And we should have initiated some of these energy-saving and emissions-reducing measures decades ago, regardless of any concerns about global warming. Quests to avoid unnecessary energy use, to reduce air pollution and water, and to provide more comfortable living conditions should be perennial imperatives, not sudden desperate actions aimed at preventing a catastrophe. Most remarkably, we have largely ignored taking steps that could have limited the long-term impacts of climate change and that should have been taken even in the absence of any global warming concerns because they bring long-term savings and provide more comfort. And as if that were not enough, we have deliberately introduced and promoted the diffusion of new energy conversions that have boosted the consumption of fossil energies and hence further intensified CO2 emissions. The best examples of these emissions and commissions are the indefensibly inadequate building codes in cold climate countries and the worldwide adoption of SUVs. Because our houses are around for a long time, a well-built, properly maintained wood-frame North American house with a concrete foundation can last for more than 100 years. With proper wall insulation, triple window panes and highly efficient heating furnaces, they represent a unique opportunity for long-lasting energy and hence carbon emissions savings. In 1973, when OPEC quintupled the world price of crude oil, most buildings in Europe, North America, and North China had just single-pane windows. In Canada, triple panes will not be mandated before 2030, and Manitoba was the first province to require high-efficiency, greater than 90% natural gas-fired furnaces in 2009, decades after such options became commercially available. Would it not be interesting to know how many delegates to global warming meetings coming from cold climates have triple panes filled with inert gas, super-insulated walls, and 97% efficient gas furnaces? Analogically, how many people in hot climates have properly sealed rooms so that their poorly installed and inefficient window air conditioners don't waste cool air? SUV ownership began to rise in the US during the late 1980s. It eventually diffused globally, and by 2020, the average SUV emitted annually about 25% more CO2 than a standard car. Multiply that by the 250 million SUVs on the road in 2020, and you will see how the worldwide embrace of these machines has wiped out several times over any decarbonisation gains resulting from the slowly spreading ownership, just 10 million in 2020, of electric vehicles. During the 2010s, SUVs became the second highest cause of rising CO2 emissions, behind electricity generation and ahead of heavy industry, trucking and aviation. If their mass public embrace continues, they have the potential to offset any carbon savings from the more than 100 million electric vehicles that might be on the road by 2040. The second chapter of this book detailed the high energy cost of modern food production and noted indefensibly high levels of food waste. Clearly, this combination presents many opportunities for reducing not only CO2 emissions, but also CH4 emissions from rice cultivation and ruminant livestock, and N2O emissions from the excessive application of nitrogen fertilizer, as well as the emissions from questionable food trade. Is it necessary to airlift blueberries from Peru to Canada in January and green beans from Kenya to London? The vitamin C and roughage these foodstuffs provide can be secured from many other sources with much lower carbon footprints. And could not we, with our immense data processing capabilities, price food better and more flexibly in order to make a major dent in the 30 to 40% waste rate? Why not do what can be done, profitably and immediately, rather than waiting for more modelling exercises? The list of what we have not but could have done is long. And what have we done to avert or to reverse the unfolding environmental change in the 3 decades since global warming became a dominant topic of modern discourse? The data are clear. Between 1989 and 2019, we increased global anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions by about 65%. Even when we deconstruct this global mean, we see that affluent countries like the US, Canada, Japan, Australia, and those in the EU, whose per capita energy use was very high 3 decades ago, did reduce their emissions, but only by about 4%, while Indian emissions quadrupled and Chinese emissions rose 4.5 times. The combination of our inaction and of the extraordinarily difficult nature of the global warming challenge is best illustrated by the fact that 3 decades of large-scale international climate conferences have had no effect on the course of global CO2 emissions. The UN's first conference on climate change took place in 1992. Annual climate change conferences began in 1995 in Berlin and included much publicised gatherings in Kyoto, 1997 with its completely ineffective agreement, Marrakesh, 2001, Bali, 2007, Cancun, 2010, Lima, 2014, and Paris, 2015. Clearly, the delegates loved to travel to scenic destinations with hardly any thought of the dreaded carbon footprint generated by this global jetting. In 2015, when about 50,000 people flew to Paris in order to attend yet another conference of the parties, at which they were to strike, we were assured, a landmark and also ambitious and unprecedented agreement. And yet the Paris Accord did not, could not, codify any specific reduction targets by the world's largest emitters, and it would, even if all voluntary, non-binding pledges were honoured, something utterly improbable, result in a 50% increase of emissions by 2050. Some landmark. These meetings could never have stopped either the expansion of China's coal extraction, it more than tripled between 1995 and 2019, to nearly as much as the rest of the world combined, or the just noted worldwide preference for massive SUVs, and they could not have dissuaded millions of families from purchasing, as soon as their rising incomes allowed, new air conditioners that will work through the hot, humid nights of monsoonal Asia, and hence will not be energized by solar electricity anytime soon. The combined effect of these demands, between 1992 and 2019, the global emissions of CO2 rose by about 65%, those of CH4 by about 25%. What can we do during the coming decades? We must start with the recognition of fundamental realities. We used to consider a 2 degrees Celsius increase in average global temperature as a relatively tolerable maximum. But in 2018, the IPCC lowered that to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. But by 2020, we have already added 2/3 of that maximum preferable temperature rise. Moreover, in 2017, an assessment that considered the capacity of the oceans to absorb carbon, the planet's energy imbalances, and the behaviour of fine particles in the atmosphere concluded that the committed global warming arising from past emissions and becoming a reality even if all new emissions ceased instantly, had already added up to 1.3 degrees Celsius, and hence it would require only an additional 15 years of new emissions to surpass 1.5 degrees Celsius. The latest analysis of these combined effects concluded that we are already committed to global warming of 2.3 degrees Celsius. As always, these conclusions have their own margins of error, but it seems highly likely that the proverbial horse of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming has already bolted. Even so, many institutions, organizations, and governments are still theorizing about keeping it inside the broken corral. The IPCC report on 1.5 degrees Celsius warming offers a scenario based on such a sudden and persistent reversal of our reliance on fossil fuels that the global emissions of CO2 would be halved by 2030 and eliminated by 2050. And other scenario builders are now offering detailed suggestions on how to achieve a rapid end to the fossil carbon era. Computers make it easy to construct many scenarios of rapid carbon elimination, but those who chart their preferred paths to a zero-carbon future owe us realistic explanations, not just sets of more or less arbitrary and highly improbable assumptions detached from technical and economic realities and ignoring the embedded nature, massive scale, and enormous complexity of our energy and material systems. Three recent exercises provide excellent illustrations of these flights of fancy unencumbered by real-world considerations. Wishful thinking. The first scenario, prepared mostly by EU researchers, assumes that average global per capita energy demand in 2050 will be 52% lower than it was in 2020. Such a drop would make it easy to keep the global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius. That is, if we still believe that such a thing is possible. Of course, and as I will reiterate in the final chapter, when constructing long-range scenarios, we can plug in any arbitrary assumptions in order to meet preconceived outcomes. But how do the assumptions of this scenario align with the recent past? Cutting per capita energy demand by half in 3 decades would be an astonishing accomplishment, given the fact that over the previous 30 years, global per capita energy demand rose by 20%. The projection assumes that the much lower demand for energy will arise from a combination of moving away from owning goods, the digitalization of daily life, and a rapid diffusion of technical innovations in converting and storing energies. The suggested first driver of disappearing demand, owning less, is an academic belief for which there is very little evidence, as all major categories of personal consumption, measured by annual household expenditures, have been rising even in affluent countries. In already highly saturated markets with already congested traffic, the EU's car ownership per 1,000 people rose by 13% between 2005 and 2017, and during the past 25 years, it was up about 25% in Germany and 20% in France. Reduced demand and gradual declines in ownership are desirable and likely. Halving the demand is an arbitrary and unlikely target. More importantly, the proponents of this unrealistic scenario allow merely a factor of 2 increase across all modes of mobility during the next 3 decades in what they call the Global South, a common but highly inaccurate designation of low-income nations, mostly in Asia and Africa, and a factor of 3 increase in the ownership of consumer goods. But in the China of the past generation, growth has been on an entirely different scale. In 1999, the country had just 0.34 cars per 100 urban households. In 2019, the number surpassed 40. That is more than 100-fold relative increase in only 2 decades. In 1990, 1 out of every 300 urban households had an air conditioning window unit. By 2018, there were 142.2 units per 100 households, a more than 400-fold rise in less than 3 decades. Consequently, even if those countries whose standard of living is today where China's was in 1999, were to achieve only a tenth of China's recent growth, they would experience a 10-fold increase of car ownership and a 40-fold increase in air conditioners. Why do the prescribers of the low energy demand scenario think that today's Indians and Nigerians do not want to narrow the gap that separates them from China's material ownership? Not surprisingly, the latest Global Production Gap Report, an annual publication highlighting the discrepancy between fossil fuel production planned by individual countries and the global emission levels necessary to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, does not show any commitments to plunging trend lines, just the opposite, in fact. In 2019, the major consumers of fossil energies were aiming to produce 120% more fuels by 2030 than would be consistent with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And whatever the eventual effect of the COVID-19 pandemic, the resulting decline of consumption will be both temporary and too small to reverse the general trend. In the second scenario, conforming to the goal of complete decarbonisation by 2050, a large group of energy researchers at Princeton University have charted the required shifts in the US. The Princeton scenario builders recognise that it will be impossible to eliminate all fossil fuel consumption and that the only way to achieve net zero emissions is to resort to what they label the fourth pillar of their overall strategy, to mass-scale carbon capture and storage of emitted CO2, and their calculation requires the removal of 1 to 1.7 gigatons of the gas per year. When compared on a volume equivalent basis, that would necessitate the creation of an entirely new gas capture transportation storage industry that every year would have to handle 1.3 to 2.4 times the volume of current US crude oil production, an industry that took more than 160 years and trillions of dollars to build. The majority of this carbon storage is to take place along the Texas Gulf Coast, and this would require building about 110,000 kilometres of new CO2 pipelines, necessitating an utterly unprecedented speed in the planning, permitting and constructing of such extensive links in a society famous for its litigiousness and NIMBY resistance. At the same time, additional monies would have to be spent on dismantling the existing transmission infrastructure of the US oil and gas industry. Given the rich historical experience with massive long-term cost overruns, any cost estimates for expenditure over the next three decades cannot be trusted even as far as their order of magnitude is concerned. Achieving complete decarbonisation by 2050 is a tame goal compared to the third scenario, which extends the goals of the US Green New Deal, introduced in the US Congress in 2019, to 143 countries and outlines how at least 80% of global energy supply will be decarbonised by 2030, thanks to renewable wind, water and solar, WWS energy, the supply of which will reduce overall needs by 57%, financial costs by 61%, and social, health and climate costs by 91%. Thus, 100% WWS needs less energy, costs less, and creates more jobs than current energy. There is no shortage of media, celebrities and best-selling authors repeating, supporting and amplifying these claims, ranging, no surprise, from Rolling Stone to The New Yorker, and from Noam Chomsky, who adds energy as his latest field of expertise, to Jeremy Rifkin, who believes that without such an intervention, our fossil-fueled civilization will collapse by 2028. If true, these claims and their enthusiastic endorsements raise the obvious question. Why should we worry about global warming? Why be frightened by the idea of early planetary demise? Why feel compelled to join Extinction Rebellion? Who could be against solutions that are both cheap and nearly instantly effective, that will create countless well-paying jobs and ensure carefree futures for coming generations? Let us all just sing from these green hymnals. Let us follow all renewable prescriptions, and a new global nirvana will arrive in just a decade. Or, if things get a bit delayed, by 2035. Alas, a close reading reveals that these magic prescriptions give no explanation for how the four material pillars of modern civilization cement, steel, plastic and ammonia will be produced solely with renewable electricity, nor do they convincingly explain how flying, shipping and trucking, to which we owe our modern economic globalisation, could become 80% carbon-free by 2030. They merely assert that it could be so. Attentive listeners will remember, in Chapter 1, that during the first decades of the 21st century, Germany's unprecedented quest for decarbonisation, based on wind and solar, succeeded in boosting the shares of wind and solar-generated electricity to more than 40%, but it lowered the share of fossil fuels in the country's primary energy use only from about 84% to 78%. What miraculous options will be available to African nations now relying on fossil fuels to supply 90% of their primary energy in order to drive their dependence to 20% within a decade while also saving enormous sums of monies? And how will China and India, both countries are still expanding their coal extraction and coal-fired generation, suddenly become coal-free? But these specific critiques of published rapid-speed transformation narratives are really beside the point. It makes no sense to argue with the details of what are essentially the academic equivalents of science fiction. They start with arbitrarily set goals, zero by 2030 or by 2050, and work backwards to plug in assumed actions to fit those achievements, with actual socioeconomic needs and technical imperatives being of little or no concern. Reality thus presses in from both ends. The sheer scale, cost, and technical inertia of carbon-dependent activities make it impossible to eliminate all of these uses in just a few decades. As I detailed in the chapter on energy, we cannot sever that dependence so rapidly. And every realistic long-term forecast concurs. Most notably, even the IEA's most aggressive decarbonisation scenario has fossil fuels supplying 56% of the global primary energy demand by 2040. Similarly, the enormous scale and cost of material and energy demands make it impossible to resort to direct air capture as a decisive component of rapid global decarbonisation. But we can make a great deal of difference, not by pretending to follow unrealistic and arbitrary goals. All too obviously, history does not unfold as a computerised academic exercise with major achievements falling on years ending with zero or five. It is full of discontinuities, reversals, and unpredictable departures. We can proceed fairly fast with the displacement of coal-fired electricity by natural gas. When produced and transported without significant methane leakage, it has a substantially lower carbon intensity than coal, and by expanding solar and wind electricity generation. We can move away from SUVs and accelerate mass-scale deployment of electric cars, and we still have large inefficiencies in construction, household and commercial energy use that can be profitably reduced or eliminated. But we cannot instantly change the course of a complex system consisting of more than 10 billion tons of fossil carbon and converting energies at a rate of more than 17 terawatts just because somebody decides that the global consumption curve will suddenly reverse its centuries-long ascent and go immediately into a sustained and relatively fast decline. Models, doubts, and realities. Why is it that some scientists keep on charting such arbitrarily bending and plunging curves leading to near-instant decarbonisation? And why are others promising the early arrival of technical superfixes that will support high standards of living for all humanity? And why are these wishful offerings taken so often for reliable provisions and are readily believed by people who would never try to question their assumptions? I will have more to say about this in the closing chapter, but here are some observations related to the now so dominant concern of global environmental change. De omnibus dubitandum, doubt everything, must be more than a durable Cartesian quote. It must remain the very foundation of the scientific method. Recall how I opened this chapter with a list of 9 planetary boundaries whose transgressions imperil our biospheric well-being. Keeping them within safe confines seems to be an obvious conclusion because they identify the most important, perennial, existential concerns, and yet a list prepared 40 years ago would have been very different. Acid rain, or more correctly acidifying precipitation, would have been most likely its top item, because a broad consensus of the early 1980s saw it as the leading environmental problem. Stratospheric ozone depletion would have been absent because the infamous Antarctic ozone hole was discovered only in 1985. And, if listed at all, anthropogenic climate change and associated ocean acidification would have been near the bottom. and even when focusing on such perennial concerns as land use changes, dominated by deforestation, loss of biodiversity, from iconic pandas and koalas to bee colonies and sharks, and fresh water supply, our concerns have evolved considerably. Becoming more acute in some ways, we now worry more about withdrawals of underground water and about excessive nutrients creating coastal dead zones, and less pressing in others. Perhaps most notably, forests have made substantial comebacks, not only in all affluent countries, but also in China. When looking ahead, we must regain a critical perspective when dealing with all models exploring environmental, technical, and social complexities. There are no limits to assembling such models or, as fashionable lingo has it, constructing narratives. Their authors can choose, as so many recent climate models have done recently, excessive assumptions about future energy use, and they can end up with very high rates of warming that generate news headlines about hellish futures. Taking the opposite approach, other modellers can posit 100% inexpensive thermonuclear electricity or cold fusion by 2050. Or, alternatively, they can allow for the unlimited expansion of fossil fuel combustion because their model deploys miraculous techniques that will not only remove any volume of CO2 from the atmosphere, but recycle it as a feedstock for synthesizing liquid fuel, all at a steadily declining cost. Of course, they just march along with the new tech crowd whose naivety compares every technical change to recent developments in electronics and above all, to mobile phones. Here is how a green energy CEO put it in 2020. Do you remember how we transformed telephony from fixed-line phones to mobile phones, television from watching whatever was on TV to whatever we fancied, from buying newspapers to customizing our news feeds? The people-led, tech-powered energy revolution is going to be just the same. How could changing a device, landline to mobile, whose reliable use depends on a massive, complex, and highly reliable system of electricity generation, dominated by thousands of large fossil-fueled hydro and nuclear power plants, transformation and transmission, encompassing hundreds of thousands of kilometers of national and even continental-scale grids, be the same as changing the entire underlying system? Much of this unmoored thinking comes out as intended, ranging from scary to wonderful, and I can see why many people are taken in either by these threats or by unrealistic suggestions. Only the imagination limits these assumptions. They range from fairly plausible to patently delusionary. This is a new scientific genre where heavy doses of wishful thinking are commingled with a few solid facts. All of these models should be seen mainly as heuristic exercises, as bases for thinking about options and approaches, never to be mistaken for prescient descriptions of our future. I wish this admonition would be as obvious, as trivial, and as superfluous as it seems. Regardless of the perceived or modelled severity of global environmental challenges, there are no swift, universal, and widely affordable solutions to tropical deforestation or biodiversity loss, to soil erosion, or to global warming. But global warming presents an uncommonly difficult challenge precisely because it is a truly global phenomenon, and because its largest anthropogenic cause is the combustion of fuels that constitute the massive energetic foundations of modern civilization. As a result, non-carbon energies could completely displace fossil carbon in a matter of 1 to 3 decades, only if we were willing to take substantial cuts to the standard of living in all affluent countries and deny the modernizing nations of Asia and Africa improvements in their collective lots by even a fraction of what China has done since 1980. Still, major reductions in carbon emissions resulting from the combination of continued efficiency gains, better system designs, and moderated consumption are possible, and a determined pursuit of these goals would limit the eventual rate of global warming. But we cannot know to what extent we will succeed by 2050, and thinking about 2100 is truly beyond our ken. We can outline extreme cases, but in just a few decades the fan of possible outcomes becomes too wide. And in any case, the progress of any eventual decarbonisation is contingent not only on our deliberate remedial actions, but also on unpredictable intervening changes in national fortunes. Was there a single climate modeller who predicted in 1980 the most important anthropogenic factor driving global warming over the past 30 years, the economic rise of China? At that time, even the best models, all being direct descendants of global atmospheric circulation models developed during the 1960s, had no way of reflecting unpredictable shifts in national fortunes, and they also ignore the interactions between the atmosphere and the biosphere. That did not make these models useless. They assumed the continued global growth of greenhouse gas emissions, and in general, they were fairly accurate in predicting the rate of global warming. But a good estimate of the overall rate is only the beginning. To use, once again, the COVID-19 analogy, this is akin to making a forecast in 2010 that, based on the last three pandemics and adjusted for a larger population, global deaths during the first year of the next global pandemic would be about 2 million. That would be very close to the actual total, but would that forecast, correctly assuming, based on many precedents, that the pandemic would start in China, also assign only 0.24% of those deaths, in absolute terms, less than in Greece or Austria, to China, a country with nearly 20% of the global population, and nearly 20% to the US, a far richer, and it certainly believes this about itself, far more competent country with less than 5% of the global population? And even more incredibly, would it predict that the highest mortalities would be concentrated in the most affluent Western economies, those that boast about their state-delivered advanced healthcare? In March 2021, as the pandemic entered officially its second year, the WHO proclaimed it on March 11, 2020, although the infection had been spreading in China at least since December 2019, all the top 10 countries with the highest cumulative mortalities, above 1,500 per million, or 1.5 out of every 1,000 people died of COVID-19, were in Europe, including 6 EU members and the UK. And who could predict that the US rate, also above 1,500, would be two orders of magnitude above China's 3 deaths per 1 million? Obviously, even a highly accurate forecast of total interim COVID-19 mortality would provide no specific guidance for formulating the best national responses. Analogically, the post-1980 rise of China, as well as India, has changed the circumstances of any response to rising global trace gas emissions. In 1980, 4 years after Mao Zedong's death, China's per capita economic product was less than one quarter of the Nigerian mean. There were no private passenger cars, only the top Communist Party leaders living in the seclusion of Zhongnanhai, the former imperial garden within the Forbidden City. Now the central headquarters of the Communist Party had air conditioning, and China produced just 10% of global CO2 emissions. By 2019, China was, in terms of purchasing power, the world's largest economy. Its per capita GDP was 5 times the Nigerian mean. The country was the world's largest producer of cars. Half of all urban households had 2 window-mounted air conditioning units. The length of its rapid train network surpassed the combined length of all the EU's links, and about 150 million of its citizens had travelled overseas. The country also emitted 30% of the world's CO2 from fossil fuels. In contrast, the combined emissions of the USA and EU28 fell from 60% of the world total in 1980 to 23% by 2019. And, because of slow rates of economic growth, ageing, even declining populations, and large-scale offshoring of industrial production to Asia, their combined share is highly unlikely to rise ever again. Looking ahead, most of the power to enact meaningful change will lie more and more in the modernizing economies of Asia, excluding high-income and low or no population growth Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. The continent is now producing half of all emissions. And while the unfolding transformation of sub-Saharan Africa has been much slower, its combined population of about 1.1 billion will nearly double during the next 30 years. It will contain almost 50% more people than China, the country that all low-income economies wish to emulate, and a critical assessment of the continent's electricity future points to a high carbon lock-in, with fossil fuel generation dominant and with the share of non-hydro renewables remaining below 10% in 2030. The rise and fall of nations is not the only uncertainty concerning the progress and effects of global warming. Recent good news is that the world's forests have been a large and persistent carbon sink, storing more than they emit, locking away about 2.4 billion tonnes of carbon every year between 1990 and 2007, and satellite data for 2000 to 2017 indicate that one-third of the world's vegetated area has been greening, showing a significant increase in the average annual green leaf area, confirming that more carbon is now absorbed and stored, and only 5% has been browning, showing significant loss of leaves. This effect has been particularly notable in intensively cultivated croplands in China and India, and in China, the effect has also been seen in the country's expanding forests. But the not-so-good news, you knew it was coming, is that between 1900 and 2015, the biosphere lost 14% of its trees due to cutting, and, no less significantly, tree mortality doubled during that time, with older and taller trees accounting for a larger share of this loss. The world's forests are getting younger and shorter, and hence are not able to store as much carbon as in the past. Increased growth rates appear to be shortening trees' lifespans across almost all species and climates, and so the existence of substantial carbon sinks may be only transient. And how many times have you heard that inevitably the first places to succumb to rising sea levels caused by global warming will be the low-lying coasts in general and island nations in the Pacific in particular? And yet a recent analysis of 4 decades of shoreline change in all 101 islands in the Pacific atoll nation of Tuvalu, north of Fiji, east of the Solomon Islands, shows that the nation's land area has actually increased by nearly 3%. Preconceived and rashly generalizing conclusions should always be avoided. The evolution of societies is affected by the unpredictability of human behavior, by sudden shifts of long-lasting historical trajectories, by the rise and fall of nations, and is accompanied by our ability to enact meaningful changes. These realities affect many inherently complex and far from satisfactorily understood biospheric processes, and because they elicit often contradictory natural responses, such as forests being both sinks and sources of carbon, it is impossible to say with confidence where we will be in terms of fossil fuel consumption, the pace of decarbonisation, or environmental consequences in 2030 or 2050. Most notably, what remains in doubt is our collective, in this case global, resolve to deal effectively with at least some critical challenges. Solutions, adjustments, and adaptations are available. Affluent countries could reduce their average per capita energy use by large margins and still retain a comfortable quality of life. Widespread diffusion of simple technical fixes, ranging from mandated triple windows to designs of more durable vehicles, would have significant cumulative effects. The halving of food waste and changing the composition of global meat consumption would reduce carbon emissions without degrading the quality of food supply. Remarkably, these measures are absent, or rank low, in typical recitals of coming low-carbon revolutions that rely on as yet unavailable mass-scale electricity storage, or on the promise of unrealistically massive carbon capture and its permanent storage underground. There is nothing new about these exaggerated expectations. In 1991, a well-known environmental activist wrote about abating global warming for fun and profit. If this promise would have even remotely resembled reality, we would not be faced, 3 decades later, with the increasing anguish of today's warming catastrophists. Similarly, we are now promised even more astonishing disruptive innovations and AI-driven solutions. The reality is that any sufficiently effective steps will be decidedly non-magical, gradual, and costly. We have been transforming the environment on increasing scales and with rising intensity for millennia. And we have derived many benefits from these changes, but inevitably the biosphere has suffered. There are ways to reduce those impacts, but the resolve to deploy them at required scales has been lacking. And if we start acting in a sufficiently effective manner, and this now requires doing so on a global scale, we will have to pay a considerable economic and social price. Will we eventually do so deliberately with foresight? Will we act only when forced by deteriorating conditions? Or will we fail to act in a meaningful way?